The headlines: the foreign ministers of Russia and Ukraine meet in Turkey, the first such high-level talks since the start of the conflict between the two countries. Iran says the talks on the revival of the JCPOA in Vienna are getting more complicated every hour, with the U.S. not making a political decision. And also ahead, the United Nations War Crimes Panel calls for U.S. probe into the civilian casualties of its airstrikes in Syria. Hello and welcome, everybody. The besieged city of Mariupol is at the center of the news on the 15th day of the Russian offensive in Ukraine. Latest reports suggest Russia is now in control of some parts of the strategic port city. The news comes right on the heels of a controversy over the bombing of the hospital there. Kiev and Moscow are giving conflicting accounts about the strike. Ukraine says the target has been a working maternity hospital with women and labor injured in the Russian attack, but Moscow is calling it fake news, saying the hospital has been empty and used as a military base by Ukrainian troops. In another development, Ukraine says it's opening 7 humanitarian corridors for civilian evacuations, including in Mariupol. Meanwhile, a meeting between Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and his Ukrainian counterpart Dmytro Kuleba has just started in Turkey. This is the first such high-level talk since the start of the conflict. We'll bring you the latest from the meeting as more information becomes available. The United States and the European Union target Russia with sweeping new sanctions in response to Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. Now Washington is reportedly weighing sanctions on Russian nuclear power supplier Rosatom. A senior U.S. administration official says a final decision has not been made yet. The European Union has placed 146 Russian lawmakers, 14 Kremlin-linked oligarchs, and their families on its sanctions list. Brussels is also planning to broaden the measures to include cryptocurrencies. The new sanctions come a day after Washington banned Russian energy imports. In response, Moscow said it was working on a broad response to Western sanctions. Russia says the measures will be swift and the pain will be felt in the West's most sensitive areas. Meanwhile, the Russian military action is coming down hard on Ukraine's economy. Ukraine's central bank says the Russian offensive has caused a slowdown in economic activity, which has seen 5% of deposits drain out of the bank accounts of companies in 2 weeks. And the UK has announced plans to phase out imports of Russian oil and oil products by the end of the year, while the EU says it will reduce its dependence by two-thirds. The announcement has seen oil prices soar even higher, with some analysts saying it could push Europe into recession. Said Putazaz, more from London.
Already struggling with the cost of living crisis, ordinary Europeans are now feeling the pinch at the pump, with the conflict in Ukraine pushing up the already high food and fuel prices. As plans to phase out oil imports from Russia are drawn up, the ripple effects of the Ukraine crisis are being felt across the continent.
Here in London, people are feeling the economic cost of the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine at the gas pump. Prices have been rising steadily since the start of the year and have now hit a record high. And what that means is that it's going to have a knock-on effect on the cost of transporting goods and, by extension, on the already rising cost of living.
Russia is the world's second largest exporter of oil. The EU imports 27% of its oil from Russia, the UK 11%, and the US just 8%, which is why Europe will feel the effect of the bans far more acutely than the US. The EU also plans to slash its dependency on Russian gas by two-thirds this year. That's 26% of their supply.
It's hard, bloody hard, but it's possible if we're willing to go further and faster than we've done before.
But to make it possible, experts say, the Europeans will have to make difficult compromises.
For the new government in Germany actually now saying, actually, we're going to bring back nuclear. Well, that was one of the key things, that they were going to get rid of nuclear completely, very quickly indeed. Then also coal, getting rid of the coal-burning power stations, and particularly those from maybe the using Polish coal, brown coal, which is incredibly dirty.
But could all this have been prevented? While the U.S. and Europe blame Russia's ongoing military offensive in Ukraine for the soaring energy costs, Some experts say it's a crisis that could have been averted.
One of the great things about international affairs is to understand not just what you want to achieve, but what the other side wants to achieve. And where's the middle path? Russia generally would want to have a working relationship to protect its security, to make sure its confidence is there. And, you know, instead of necessarily having people who are American allies literally a few hundred miles away from your capital, that's something they're not used to. So really understand their nervousness, now try and work out how to deal with it. But we've left it too late.
The new plans will mean less oil revenues for Russia and a faster transition to cleaner energy. But what it also means is a higher risk of inflation and recession across the continent. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Washington says Moscow's accusations that it supported a military biological program in Ukraine are not only untrue, but also a sign that Russia itself could use chemical or biological weapons against its neighbor. According to the U.S. State Department, the Kremlin is inventing false claims to justify its own horrific actions in Ukraine. It says Russia's accusations targeting the West usually reflect the crimes that Moscow's perpetrating itself. The White House has also called the allegations preposterous. Russia is accusing Washington of financially supporting a bioweapons program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens such as plague and anthrax. It says the program has been urgently cleaned up. Ukrainian officials deny any such program, but the U.S. Undersecretary of State has already acknowledged that such biological research facilities did, in fact, exist in Ukraine. And Iran is standing its ground in the ongoing Vienna talks with President Ibrahim Raisi, saying there will be no backing down from the red lines. Raisi says his government seeks a removal of sanctions in a dignified manner and will strictly follow the guidelines set by Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. His comments come shortly after Iran's top security official said the U.S. approach towards the talks shows that Washington has no desire for a good deal. Ali Shamkhani said the way Washington is approaching Iran's proposals, the unacceptable proposals it tables, and its desire for a quick agreement all indicate a lack of will for a strong deal that's acceptable to both sides. According to the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, the Vienna talks are becoming more complicated by the hour because the U.S. is refraining from making a political decision. And sources close to the Iranian negotiating team in Vienna insist that the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA is contingent on political decisions by the U.S. This comes as Iran's chief negotiator Ali Boadikani held talks with the European Union's coordinator Enrique Mora in the Austrian capital. We have spoken to our correspondent in Vienna, Homolezki, for more details.
Sources close to the Iranian team continue to insist that this would only be possible if the Americans make the necessary political decisions, and that when I asked them whether there are still some outstanding issues remaining or whether those have been resolved, they are telling me that those issues are still being discussed. We still have some outstanding issues. Previously, we've been told they include the scope of sanctions. They include some reports are saying the issues of sequencing or how the implementation will take place, because, of course, once the decision is made here in Vienna for the JCPOA to be restored, you might see the foreign ministers come here to make the announcement, and then there will be a preparation period before the re-implementation day. And, of course, this involves a lot of sequencing and measures both by the Americans and the Iranians, and lengthy discussions have been taking place on what those measures need to be. And also, let's just take a look at the official positions that have been expressed by the Iranians, the Supreme National Security Council, saying that Iran believes the prospect for a deal is unclear because of Washington's delay to come up with a political decision, and saying that rapid access to a deal requires new initiatives. What we've been hearing also as creative solutions that are needed for the demands that now exist between the negotiating partners for these issues to be resolved, they still need to work on what they call creative solutions.
Iran has launched futures contracts at its energy exchange market. As Iran has the world's largest oil and gas reserves, the launch of futures can turn the country into a pricing reference for its crude oil and natural gas in the region. Salman Khudriri reports on that.
Iran has launched its futures contracts for the first time in the history of its energy exchange market. The futures contracts were launched for the naphtha and methanol trades. According to experts, futures are some very important instruments for the market balance. If other energy carriers, and especially oil, gas, and petrochemical companies, join Iran's energy exchange on futures platform, Iran's crude oil and gas is capable enough to be turned into a benchmark for pricing in the region.
As Iran has the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, the pricing benchmark for our gas and oil should not be elsewhere. The fact is that we should have our own pricing reference for our natural gas in the region. We hope that with the launch of futures and cooperation of all companies in the field of oil and gas, such a thing will happen.
Futures are some very important instruments for the market balance, while they are also some strong hedging tools. They provide investment opportunities for those who are seeking the amount of profit more than they can earn in the normal market deals.
Futures contracts are financial contracts obligating the buyer to purchase an asset or the seller to sell an asset at a predetermined date and price in the future.
The launch of futures trade markets at Iran's energy exchange will contribute to transparency and the predictability of Iran's economy. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The United Nations War Crimes Panel has called on the United States to carry out thorough probes into civilian casualties caused by the country's airstrikes in Syria. The panel has urged Washington to ensure those responsible for violations of international humanitarian laws are held accountable. It has also asked the U.S. to make its findings public. The UN call comes as the U.S. military is accused of hiding information on its airstrikes against Syria. In 2019, the New York Times had reported that the strikes, considered war crimes, claimed the lives of up to 64 Syrian women and children. Despite repeated calls, Washington has not conducted an independent probe into the 2019 bombings so far. This is while the U.S. is also under fierce criticism for its military presence in the Arab country without the permission of Damascus. Washington justifies its troop deployment there under the pretext of fighting Daesh. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country will launch a number of reconnaissance satellites in coming years as tensions continue to rise on the Korean Peninsula. North Korean leader says the new satellites will provide real-time information on military actions by the United States and its allies. Kim says a lot of military reconnaissance satellites will be put into orbit in the period of a five-year plan first announced last year. Pyongyang, which has increased its missile launches recently, says it has conducted two satellite system tests so far this year. Washington and its regional allies say the tests involved ballistic missile launches. The U.S. Indo-Pacific Command says it has heightened its ballistic missile defense readiness after, quote, a significant increase in North Korean missile testing. The final results from South Korea's presidential election show opposition candidate Yoon Suk-yeol has won the vote in one of the closest fought races in recent history. According to the National Election Commission, Yoon edged out the ruling Democratic Party's Lee Jae-myung with 48.6% of the vote to 47.8%. Lee has already conceded defeat. Yoon replaces President Moon Jae-in, whose single five-year term ends in May. Following his victory, Yoon said he would rebuild alliance with the United States and will develop relations with China based on mutual respect. The president-elect said he would respond to North Korea's, quote, nuclear threat, but would leave the door open to dialogue. He also promised to build a strong defense to deter any provocation. Earlier, we were joined by our Seoul correspondent, Frank Smith, who gave us a background of Yoon Suk-yeol's rise to politics and his surprise victory.
Certainly, if we go back, just a year or a couple of years, it's a surprise to see the rise of Yoon Suk-yeol to this position. After all, as you mentioned, he was a chief prosecutor looking into initially, like, his biggest sort of accomplishment was prosecuting former President Park Geun-hye, largely for, you know, at the behest of the Democratic Party. Then he turned the tables and investigated the Moon Jae-in administration for corruption within his executive branch. To see him enter politics at such a late stage, a relative political novice, and become president so quickly certainly is astonishing. But the race for the presidency from the time the campaign began to election day was really a two-horse race, neck and neck, from the very beginning, with polls showing different candidates depending on which week you looked at, leading heading into Wednesday's election. So it is kind of a surprise that you made it this far, but the outcome really was between those two.
In Nigeria, there are concerns over continuous holding of the passports of top Muslim cleric Sheikh Rumuzak Zeki. Danjuma Abdullahi has the details from Abuja.
Nigerians under the umbrella of the concerned Abuja indigents said the Nigerian government's refusal to release the travel documents of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat is part of the unjustifiable oppression of the Islamic cleric and his wife. The group said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has been brutalized in Zaria in December 2015, resulting in the murder of his six sons and thousands of his followers. They said the Islamic cleric has remained resolute and law-abiding, so there is need for the court to resolve the issue of his travel documents immediately.
Do we expect him dead before the judgment concluded? This is what we are talking about. If the court should keep on delaying, consigning the release of the traveling document, what do we do while the sickness keep on eating the body?
The Abuja concerned indigents said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat have dangerous levels of lead and cadmium in their blood and needed to be hospitalized. They said delaying the medical trip of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat is an infringement on their rights.
The Constitution of Nigeria has given every individual a right to express, right of movement, right to medication, right of everything. Socially. So if right has been given to every individual citizen of the country, why is Sheikh being deprived?
A Kaduna High Court had freed Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat since July 28, 2021. The Islamic cleric and his wife had dragged the Nigerian government to court over its refusal to release their passports to go for medical treatment abroad. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
in the limelight.
The White House is stopping Russian energy imports, a move which could push American gas prices even higher. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Gianna Smialek, Alan Rappaport, and Jason Horowitz. The piece is titled, "Ban on Russian Oil Could Hit the U.S. Economy as Gas Prices Rise." The ban on Russian energy imports announced by President Joe Biden on Tuesday, 8th of March, could have meaningful consequences for the U.S. economy, pushing prices at the gas pump higher when inflation is already rapid, although how long-lasting that impact might be remains uncertain. "We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy," President Biden said, speaking at a White House briefing. He said the plan would target the main artery of the Russian economy. While he acknowledged that the move would likely push gas prices in the United States up, he blamed Russia for that reality. The ban applies to imports of Russian oil, liquefied natural gas, and coal. It also prohibits new U.S. investments in Russia's energy sector, and it blocks Americans from financing or enabling foreign companies that are making investments to produce energy in Russia. Europe imports far more of its supply from Russia than the United States, but energy markets are global, and the mere threat of a ban has pushed commodity prices higher in recent days. "Things have been so volatile," said Omar Sharif, founder of Inflation Insights, noting that it was difficult to tell how much of the rise in oil prices in recent days traces back to this specific ban. But the conflict in Ukraine is clearly pushing commodity gas prices higher, so much so that the national average gas price could rise to nearly $4.50 this month, he said, assuming we don't move anymore. While the oil and gas ban is almost sure to push inflation higher in the United States, economists have said that the scale of the economic consequences would depend in large part on how it was structured. For instance, it would likely make a big difference globally and in markets if Europeans also ban Russian oil and gas imports, and it is not yet clear whether or not to what extent that will happen. A ban across many countries would severely reduce and disrupt energy supply on a global scale, and already high commodity prices would rise further, Caroline Bain, an economist at Capital Economics, wrote in a research note ahead of the announcement, estimating that the price of the global oil benchmark, the Brent crude, would settle in at about $160 per barrel in that case. The Brent crude price jumped by about 6% to roughly $130 per barrel by the middle of the day on Tuesday, 8th of March 2022. By comparison, it was about $78 per barrel at the end of 2021. It is not yet clear how many countries will adopt a similar ban. The White House signaled this week that the United States could act separately in blocking imports of Russian oil, noting that countries in Europe are far more reliant on Russian energy, something that President Biden also alluded to on Tuesday. "Many of our European allies and partners may not be in a position to join us," he said. That includes efforts by the European Union to lessen its dependence on Russian energy. Britain indicated on Tuesday, 8th of March, that it would take its own steps to ban imports of Russian energy products. Kwasi Kwarteng, Britain's business and energy secretary, said it would phase out imports of Russian oil and oil products by the end of 2022. Other European countries are under increasing pressure to follow suit. Everything's on the table, Frank Reiser, the French Minister for Foreign Trade, told the France Info radio station on Monday, adding that France had to look at potential bans on oil and gas imports from Russia with regard to consequences in terms of pressure on Russia and in terms of economic, financial and social impacts in Europe. The office of French President Emmanuel Macron said on Tuesday evening that the country had to coordinate with the European Union before taking any further steps, but acknowledged Europe's need to reduce its reliance on Russian energy. The United States is not dependent on Russian oil and gas, but the European partners are, Emmanuel Macron's office said in a statement. We have a long-term policy of getting rid of the dependence on Russian oil and gas, but in the immediate future, we need to discuss this with our European partners. While Italy is very much dependent on Russian gas, the nation's government has said that if the European Union decided to cut off its consumption of Russian gas and oil, Italy would not oppose the effort. The direct US economic impact from the loss of Russian oil is likely to be notable, though less severe than what would happen in Europe. According to the International Energy Agency, IEA, the United States imported less than 700,000 barrels of oil per day from Russia in 2021. That represents less than 10% of what the United States imports globally. Higher global oil and gas commodity prices and rising prices at the pump will add to the inflationary pain that is already dogging American consumers. Prices are climbing at the fastest pace in the past 40 years, and data this week is expected to show that the annual increase climbed higher in February. Rising gas prices will exacerbate that trend. The national average price hit $4.17 on Tuesday, according to the AAA, a new high for regular unleaded gas. There will be costs as well here in the United States, President Joe Biden said. Republicans and Democrats alike understand that. Mr. Omar Sharif said U.S. inflation could peak at 8.3% in March, given the jump in gas prices. Before the conflict, he had expected it to ease down to 2.7% by the end of the year, but now he is expecting a rate closer to 4.5%. Higher gas prices also eat into consumers' budgets, preventing them from spending on other things. So a ban could also have consequences for the overall economic growth in the United States. High gas prices could be a liability for Democrats during a midterm election year, given they hit American voters right in the wallet. Republicans have already seized on gas prices as a talking point. Under Joe Biden, families are paying more for gas than ever before, Ronna McDaniel, chairwoman of the Republican National Committee, said in a statement on Tuesday, 8th of March. But the White House is emphasizing that the price increases are the result of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and President Biden pointed out that the United States and its partners are releasing global petroleum reserves.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Ukrainian conflict is taking a toll on the world in more ways than one. On the one hand, there is the U.S. ban on Russian oil imports, with oil prices to have surged to their highest since the 2008 financial crisis. Prices at the pump have actually shocked Americans. Meanwhile, Europeans, they're also suffering as a result from soaring energy prices to inflation. The U.S. President Joe Biden, meanwhile, is looking for alternatives. It has tried to reach out to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, but his calls have gone unreturned from both of them. It is not clear whether Joe Biden actually will be successful in filling the void. This edition of The Spotlight, we will cover the dangers facing the world as a result of Russia's military operation against Ukraine, especially on the economic front. Well, joining us to discuss this is Scott Ritter. He's the former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer, who will join us from Bethlehem, New York. Also joining us is Arnold August, author and journalist, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, I'd like to welcome you both. Arnold, August, let me first start with you. We are looking at record oil prices, as you're well aware, at this point, hovering at maybe close to $140 a barrel. We're looking at the U.S. to actually have gone ahead making the decision that it's not going to import any oil from Russia. The Europeans have come out. I guess they're going to phase out their Russian oil imports also as a result of this. But it's not clear where the replacement is going to come. Why have they not pre-planned this so that we're not looking at Americans, for example, suffering based on this economically, prices at the pump, and of course all the different areas that this will have an impact on?
Well, as the saying goes, every cloud has a silver lining. As you say, the situation is terrible, what is happening in Ukraine, but the positive side, if I may say so, is that some countries, especially in the south, are starting to resist the attempt by the United States to shift the cause and consequences of their disastrous Ukraine policy. For example, when the vote took place in the United Nations, it is said that there were 35 abstentions. Well, that's pretty good. I mean, we expected, of course, China and Cuba, their socialist country, they did not fully agree with the Russian military operation, but they abstained. But also in that list of abstentions, and this is being played out now as we speak with regards to oil, you have Pakistan, India, South Africa, which are important players in international arena. And so, Biden sent an official delegation to Venezuela. It was quite ironic, not only opposing the Maduro government, trying actively to overthrow it. So it have to go almost begging to Venezuela to get oil from Venezuela. And there are other factors which the United States are not taking into account. For example, Lithuania, who voted in favor of the U.S. resolution against Russia in the United Nations General Assembly, guess what they just did? They stopped their export of COVID vaccination to Bangladesh, which, internationally didn't create much of a storm, but I'm sure quite a few people and countries in the South noticed that. And Pakistan did not vote, actually abstained. Pakistan abstained. And further, the leader of Pakistan made it very clear, we are not going to follow what the U.S. says, we cannot follow the U.S. dictate.
Okay. Let me bring in Scott Ritter here. Scott Ritter, so you're looking at the obvious embargo against Russia when it comes to oil that is pretty severe. But at the same time, the replacement and the extremes, in one sense, that the U.S. has gone to, for example, going to Venezuela, that it doesn't officially recognize the Maduro government and does not have any relationships with it, but now it does, it seems, in their eyes, that it has a reason to. Do you think that there also is an incentive there to try to break Russia's allies like Venezuela away from Russia by this move, but at the same time, obviously, wanting its oil?
Well, there's no doubt that the United States is seeking to break up whatever coalition, alliance, whatever you want to call it, that Russia had assembled in support. Look, Russia knew that this was coming. That none of what's happening right now is taking Russia by surprise. None of it. To include the U.S. going to Venezuela. I can guarantee you that Russian diplomats have been in lengthy conversations with their Venezuelan colleagues about, you know, what the U.S. was planning to do, what the U.S. has done, and what the U.S. is going to do in the future. The United States is about to find out that the Russians are far better prepared for what's getting ready to happen than the United States and Europe. The United States and Europe have used the sanctions weapon, you know, far too freely, and they've picked the wrong nation to sanction harshly. Russia is, I believe, on the verge of announcing some major counterattacks, up to and including the absolute decoupling of Russia from the West. See, the West believes that Russia will suffer because Russia wants to be a part of the West, and therefore removing Russia from that which defines the West will harm Russia. Sure, Russia is going to pay a price in the short term, but in the long term, we're going to be looking at a strategic Russian pivot toward China, Eurasia, the development of a trans-Eurasian market where Russian energy will feature prominently. And you're seeing that other parts of the world, for instance, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and I'm betting you not even Venezuela in a major way, are willing to step up and increase oil production for the benefit of the United States. Venezuela may well sell oil because its economy is in tatters. But the likelihood of the United States, for instance, getting Venezuela to walk away from Russia, one of the nations that stood up for Venezuela at a time when the United States was seeking to strangle it to death, and go back to the United States, which has not changed its fundamental opposition to the Maduro regime, the likelihood of that happening is zero.
Well, when our guest there, Arnold August, talks about the decoupling, he talked about how the United States and Europe have another thing coming because Russia is well prepared. Do you agree with him?
Yeah, sure. I agree with what the previous speaker said. It's absolutely true. I mean, people in the West are so enamored or impressed by the mainstream media disinformation with regards to Russia trying to paint the president of Putin and the Russian government as amateurs. They don't know what they're doing. They're desperate and all that. But the fact is, they know what they're doing. You know, when they decided to take that military operation in Ukraine, they knew what was coming. But they, looking at from their point of view, they had no other choice. So I think that decoupling is important, but it actually began several years ago. Russia preparing an economic collaboration with, as well as. And so this whole realignment, or what some people call the push towards a more multipolar world, is perhaps what provoked the United States to make that push their position to include Ukraine into NATO, which was the red line on which Russia cannot act. So we actually have a continuation of the international trend of a multipolar world emerging more stronger. And since the U.S., Canadian, and other countries' sanctions against Russia, this is only going to drive those, especially in the third world, whether it's Asia, Latin America, and Africa, South Africa also abstained in the United Nations General Assembly, to close ranks to protect themselves against what they correctly view, in my point, from my vantage point, the really arrogant attitude, foreign policy attitude of the United States to Ukraine. Just falsely say everyone's going to fall into place with the United States. That's not happening. But the big question is, I don't know what Scott would have to say about this. What about Europe that has, you know, that tradition of not following the United States right to the hilt, for example, France with regard to NATO? Will Europe finally wake up and say, wow, we were wrong to get into bed with the United States on the Ukraine issue? Our people are suffering. Will that happen? I don't know.
Scott Ruther, will that happen?
You know, Europe is caught up in a couple of things. One, NATO. The majority of European nations are part of the NATO alliance, and so that is a trap. Two, the European Union. And the European Union, its development as a political and economic union closely parallels NATO in terms of goals and objectives. That's a second trap. And then the third thing is a growing recognition on the part of many European nations that the United States doesn't view it as an ally, but rather a tool to further American unilateral policy objectives. And you're starting to see resistance. But that resistance is tempered by the dual traps of economic union and NATO. And right now, if you take a look at, you know, what Russia has targeted, Russia has basically said, we're done with the European Union. We're finished with it. If you want to deal with us in the future, it's going to have to be on an individual basis. And you've seen nations, for instance, of Bulgaria said, we may leave the European Union. Hungary may leave the European Union. You're going to start to see a fracturing of the European Union. And with that comes a fracturing of NATO. And this is going to be one of the consequences of the American overreaching action regarding Russia. You know, the other thing that's going to happen really soon is Russia is going to seize the assets of every company that left Russia because they violated their contract. Russia will seize these assets and then recapitalize these assets. That's a lot of money. China's already indicated it's willing to come in and participate in that. India may do as well. What European countries are going to finally say, wait a minute, we can't afford to lose the totality of our investments. We're coming in. All these major oil companies that left, Russia's thanking them, you know, just thanking them in a big way for giving them for free $1 billion worth of investment, because Russia will own this now, and Russia has the skill, and other nations have the skill and the technology to be able to maintain and operate these giant oil fields efficiently. The West has committed suicide right now. That literally, you're going to see a collapse of the European economy. The United States is going to be struggling, and there is no option. There is no plan B out of this. Again, I just think the United States has blinded itself with arrogance and hubris to undertake a course of action that has not been well thought through.
Well, talk about fractures, or should I say divisions, Arnold August. Nothing is more glaringly evident than what has occurred in the past, days, where the Saudi and Emirati leaders actually have snubbed President Joe Biden, not even returning his call, from what we understand. It's actually some saying that this has happened in the past few weeks, where Biden has encouraged the two, or has the intention of encouraging them to pump more oil into the market, I guess. But that shouldn't really come as a surprise either, come to think of it, when we looked at how you had the prices at the pump in the States go up. Joe Biden actually reached out to OPEC and asked point blank for there to be more oil pumped in a message to Saudi Arabia, but they said no. Are we looking at a divergence there in a major way between Saudi Arabia and the U.S., even though we know Joe Biden doesn't speak to the Saudi Crown Prince?
Yeah, I think that this is definitely what's happening. This fracture is happening. I would just, what you mentioned is very important, just to add one point in order to support, you know, this view that everything is not going very well for the United States. You know, let's keep in mind that the president of Hungary has been, Ukraine, Zelensky, he has been begging, asking for U.S. intervention in Ukraine in order to support what they call their struggle against Russia. Of course, this is very ghoulish. No one could ever support that. But it is plain for everyone to see in the world stage that the United States, you know, they don't consider their allies as allies, such as Ukraine, or as they did Afghanistan before they walked out of Afghanistan and left all of their partners in a dire situation in Afghanistan. Now with Ukraine, it's clear for everyone to see. They were and are using Ukraine as a proxy, military proxy, in order to further U.S. intentions towards Russia. And, you know, no one hopes that the United States will come in to help Ukraine, but it does not fall on deaf ears, especially in Europe, I would say, but also in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, that no country in the world, even a country that acts as a virtual Trojan horse for the United States and Europe, that is the Ukrainian government, not even that government can count on the United States. So I think it's also going to influence the situation geopolitically in the next weeks and months.
Scott Ritter, I got to ask you this because we just covered this in the past hour where there was a press conference between the U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and his counterpart Liz Truss. And what Liz Truss said really stood out. And I'd like to find out from you when there was a question asked from her about a no-fly zone for protecting humanitarian corridors. She said, while requesting Russia to honor it, the reality is this would lead, I'm quoting her, to a direct confrontation between NATO and Russia. We want Ukraine to meet that challenge. We are not looking at that, looking to help Ukraine defend their own country. What impression do you get from her saying that?
Well, one, simultaneously a very realistic approach and an unrealistic approach. Let's leave Liz Truss out of this mix for a second and just understand that she's merely echoing policies made by others. NATO made it clear going in that they were not going to come to the assistance of Ukraine if Russia invaded. They said, you're not a member. You therefore are not, the Article 5 protections of collective defense do not extend to you. Ukraine nonetheless continued its hardline posturing. You know, Ukraine could have stopped this conflict in a second had they simply agreed to go neutral and sign on to Minsk. You know, they would have preserved the Donbas and prevented the destruction of their country. But they chose not to. They chose to go to war under the mistaken belief that even though NATO was saying we're not coming to your assistance, then what NATO was really saying is we are coming to your assistance. Well, NATO isn't coming to their assistance. And now we come to the other unrealistic expectation. That's on the part of the West, expecting Ukraine to resist, you know, a superpower. The notion that Ukraine and the U.S. seems to have bought into its own propaganda. I mean, we won't know what the truth is about the Russian military operation until it's finished, and the Russians start producing data to back up whatever they say is happening. But, you know, the facts speak for themselves. Propaganda is one thing, reality is another. And right now, the Ukrainian government and its military are defeated. That doesn't mean that they can't continue to resist, but the outcome is inevitable. And the notion that Ukraine will somehow be able to reconstitute an air force capable of, you know, protecting its territory from the Russian air force is ludicrous, unrealistic, amateurish, an absurdity, a fantasy. And why a foreign minister of a major European country would even, you know, suggest such a thing is beyond me. It just shows that we are literally living in a horrible fantasy world. Sure. Where we've allowed propaganda to dictate reality, but perception only goes so far. At the end of the day, it's what's really happening on the ground that counts.
Sure. The notion of decoupling is my last question to you, Arnold August, that Scott Ritter talked about, of which I'd like to expand more, because we're looking at a decoupling when it comes to, for example, how the U.S. is reaching out to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and they're not really going for it. A decoupling is where the U.S. itself doesn't even know how it's going to replace its energy needs, and this comes at the expense of Americans, the Europeans, following lock and step with the U.S. In the meantime, as Scott Ritter mentioned there, Russia's alignment is going to be further to the east, solidify even more with China, with other countries most likely to also follow that. Are we seeing the U.S. break down in that sense when it comes to its approach towards Ukraine?
I definitely think that one can say at this point that the U.S. policy on Ukraine, it's a disaster. I mean, there's no way that the United States and the government of Ukraine can extricate, can get themselves out of the situation. But we just mentioned that the United States has vowed that they will not send in troops to into Ukraine and is counting on Ukraine to do it on their own. But behind that is an important point, and that is over the last few days, we have increasingly seen how the U.S., through its allies, are sending actually mercenaries into Ukraine, you know, from Syria, from other countries, from Europe, to fight in Ukraine. And even if it does contribute further to a civil war, what does the United States care about that? You know, as long as they keep Russia at bay. But I don't think they could do it with some kind of a terrorist insurgency as they tried in Syria. So I think that in the next few days, weeks, we will see the further disintegration of the what the United States would like to have is a wide spectrum of support in North America and in Europe against Russia. Okay. It's not going to be that easy for them.
All right. Unfortunately, we're just out of time. Wish we had more time for this, but I'd like to thank you both for your contributions. Scott Ritter, former U.N. Weapons Inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer. Thank you so much. And also Arnold August for his contribution, author and journalist from Montreal. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vitale, the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen from each and every single corner of the world, hope everything is just fine with you. Whatever you're doing, driving your car, walking on your feet, going back to home after a long day, or just resting at home, I welcome your entrance to an extraordinary zone. You're hearing me from IRB English Radio. Get ready to fly with us in the realm of reality with a new episode of your program, Back to Reality. This is Asma at your service as your host, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Brother Habib. Very happy to have you both in here.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm also happy to be with you always.
Yes,
everywhere.
I'm always glad to be with you.
And alaykum you, brother. Assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on board.
Yes, thank you for being here. Welcome to your program. So give us just a little bit about yourself, an introduction. Zainab, what are you studying?
Well, Asma, I'm Zainab Askari, and I'm a student of Hausa right now, and I'm done with Master's in Linguistics from University of Kashmir.
Linguistics is awesome. Okay, you, brother?
Currently studying in the Hausa, Kharij level, advanced level, and at your service.
That's so much, you're a master. In today's Back to Reality, we have an interesting topic to discuss about, which is going to be very controversial. The clause you wear. If you come to an airport and you see different kinds of women, when you see a woman wearing abaya or hijab, what is called as a scarf or something long and which is wearing every part of her body, what would you think of her? What would be your first impression about her?
The first impression that will come into my mind will be that she's a Muslim.
Yes.
Okay. The second impression will be that I'll start judging which country she belongs to. And that depends on the way she has covered herself. If she is putting on a black chador kind of thing, covering herself from head to toe, she's either from Iran, she's either from Iraq or from Lebanon.
Middle East.
Yeah, she's from Middle East.
Generally, you know? We could feel like she's from Middle East,
yeah. But then if I see a woman covered from head to toe again, mm-hmm. but in a colorful way.
Yes.
You know, putting on a long shirt and a like very loose trousers and all the way we have in Kashmir. Alhamdulillah.
Yes.
I'll say that she belongs to India or Pakistan.
So the first things we would guess about her is about
religion.
Her nationality.
Religion.
Religion at first and then her nationality.
Then nationality, yeah.
If a woman is Lebanese, if she's Saudi Arabia, she's from Kuwait or she's from Iraq, only from the shoulders that she wears, because each one has a specific way of being, you know,
Their dressing is different.
And for example, this person is from Lebanon, from Syria. What mm-hmm. part of Lebanon as well? So in some cases, what part of Iraq as well? Yes, we have experience with various people. We're Arab at the end of the day. If I see my brother in faith walking in the airport, the beard is not going
to
work.
Is it possible to guess?
It is possible in some
situations.
For
men, it's more difficult.
It's more difficult, yes, because the beard has now become a fashion trend.
Yes.
And so first of all, what I would usually look for is actually, for Shias, is actually the ring on the right hand.
Oh, wow.
Yes, that's the first thing you have to look for.
That's a good point.
And even more, we were known, Shias were known during the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam to wear the ring on the right hand. So the Imam Sadiq alayhi salam told actually his companions to not wear it out of taqiyya, out of fear of them knowing that they are Shia or not.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So this is one of the signs.
Yeah. Another thing is actually, that's a sujood thingy on their head.
Mark that you have.
The sign of praying.
Yeah, the sign of
the
praying.
The prayer that has
yes.
right now. Yeah.
And other than that, I would say sandals, but not that much to an extent.
Those people who are wearing mostly dark colors, do you consider them as unhappy people?
No.
No, I don't consider them.
You
as
won't.
There might be a connection.
You won't judge their personality.
I won't judge their personality because in our culture, the culture I mm-hmm. have grown up in, colors do not mean anything. I have seen this thing only in the Middle East. Like if you're wearing dark, it means that maybe there's some sad occasion. And if you're wearing something very bright, for example, your scarf is bright, your head covering
so
is bright.
So why has it been like this? When I'm wearing a totally black, they would judge me and they would say she's extremely religious or perhaps she's...
Can I add something very quick right here?
Yes, of course.
I think it's very important to look at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, and we said this before the show, that we have the traditions of the Prophet. It's a lifestyle. We should have mm-hmm. talked about this when we were talking about religion. Following the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi in every action that he does, in every manner that he does. We have a good book, actually. We also had a good program. Sunan